This is A Drink with a Friend. I'm Tish Oxenreiter.
And hey, I'm Seth Haynes. I'm back.
And Seth is here. It's been a hot minute. And we've got a friend with us, Haddon Turner, from across the pond. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
Hello. Okay. Seth, just because listeners are wondering what the heck happened to you, you weren't raptured. You didn't leave the internet. What's been new with you? What's going on?
Well, I wasn't raptured because I don't believe in that. If I had believed in that, maybe I would be raptured. Maybe right. That's how that works. Uh-huh. Like if you actually firmly are convinced in your heart, maybe you're raptured. I don't know. No, you know, I had a couple people reach out to me too and say, hey, do you and Tish hate each other now? Like what's going on here?
No, we don't.
And I had to assure them that no, I don't hate Tish. I love Tish. She's amazing. Yeah. She's one of my closest friends. Great human being.
We're good buds.
But I've entered into a new season it's just been grueling. We've got some things happening on the home front. I've got a lot of projects brewing at the office. And so I just needed to take a break for my sanity and for the health of, you know, some things we're working through at home with medical issues. So that's it. But otherwise, I'm very happy and very here.
All is well. No drama in the slightest. Indeed. All right.
Well, no drama in the slightest. I mean, there was that fist fight that Kyle and I got into.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But the outside drunken of that,
brawl. Right.
No drama.
Right. Right. Haddon, how are you? What time is it where you are right now?
7:50 in the evening. So not too late.
Not too bad. Okay. No. I cannot. I mean, I've been to your neck of the woods quite a few times and I still, the time change thing confuses me. All right. We didn't keep you up till 2 a.m. or something. All right. So for those of you who are not yet graced with the beauty of reading your newsletter, which is just delightful, tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do, what you write about.
Sure. So yeah, I'm Haddon from the UK, from Essex, Chelmsford, which I'm sure we'll be talking about as this is a podcast on localism. I write on agrarian themes on my Substack, Over the Field, which has been going on for now two years. It'll be 2 years in a few days' time, actually. And I write on themes such as what does it mean to be a good farmer? What does it mean to have close connection to the land? I sometimes delve into other issues such as tech and AI, which is how me and Seth connected. But mostly to do with agrarian issues, which has been a great passion of mine for the last 5 or so years. I've done 2 degrees in broadly agricultural themes. One, I've just finished a master's on agriculture development. And before that, I did an undergraduate in conservation, where I focused on farming in my final year. After being told during the first 2 years that farmers were the bad guys for conservation and nature protection, and I sort of lapped that up as a young undergraduate. And then in my final year, I started to question that a little bit and thought, is this true? Are farmers really the bad guys? I started to speak to some, started to read around and thought, actually, I think that's a very constricted view. And not one that I agree with anymore. And ever since then, I've delved deeper and deeper into agriculture, came across the writings of Wendell Berry about 4 years ago, and thought, wow, here's a thinker who is thinking all the thoughts that I've been thinking and has written them down in such a wonderful way of prose and argument and clarity and just thinking of things I'd never thought before. Thinking, wow, I found agricultural philosophy, which is the way that when people ask, what do? I say, I do agricultural philosophy. And they go, what on earth is that? And I say, well, read my Substack and hopefully you'll get an idea. That's what I do. And that's what I do mainly of my time. So since finishing university, I've been doing a research project for my professor, which I'm finishing up this week. And then I am just freelancing, writing. I run a Wendell Berry reading group online, do some poetry. I've got a few pictures in with some journals. One's about to come out of Hearth and Field shortly. Mm-hmm. yeah, that's basically what I do.
So is that all? I'm joking.
Yeah, is that it? That's it? That's all? First of all, let me just say, I love your writing. I think it's amazing. I say this not pejoratively, but I was going to say one of the finest young writers I've stumbled across in the last few years, but I don't know how young you are. So it's more like one of the finest new writers that I've run across in the last few years. I love reading your stuff. It's always insightful. It's always inspiring. But let me ask you a question, because you were talking about your younger collegiate years.
Just quickly on that, Seth, I'm 27.
Okay. That's young in my book.
You are a young guy. That makes me feel it's fantastic. So you're one of my favorite young and new writers. You said in your early collegiate years, you kind of became enamored or convinced or lapped up the idea that farmers were the bad guys. Can you dive into that a little bit?
Yeah. So this is an ongoing debate, I would say, that's very hot in the UK between farmers and conservationists. Sadly, most of the fight seems to be happening on Twitter, where it gets very, very vocal very, very quickly. But there's a prevailing view that farmers amongst conservationists that farmers have sort of bought into the conventional industrial paradigm, are farming in a way that is purely for profit, that are not looking after their lands. And there is some truth to that. You've got some farmers who don't care about wildlife, don't care about conservation, but most do. But most are so squeezed financially by the supermarkets that they can't afford to do the nature-based farming, can't afford to farm in the ways that are good for nature, because it means that they are farming in a lower intensity way, they're building habitats, they're taking parts of the land after production, and they can't afford to do that. The UK government is currently rolling out the Sustainable Farming Initiative, which is sort of a subsidy / grant / something else scheme to compensate farmers for this. But there's been all sorts of problems with that. Farmers not being consulted, some farmers being left out. So farmers feel generally squeezed. But this, I suppose the reason why my professor was saying that is that since 1970, we have seen severe declines in nature on our farms. We've seen some farmland birds, such as the turtle dove, decline by 96%. Skylarks, yellowhammers, all these characteristic birds that feature in rural literature, rural poetry, have massively declined. And that is due to the intensified farming practices that have happened post-World War II, that have really heated up around the post-war period, and it has been exacerbated ever since. I wrote an essay on this last year. The fields, in a way, are becoming silent, to use Rachel Carson's term, through intensified practice, through there being very little land left on the farm for these birds, for these butterflies, et cetera, to persist. But farmers decry that too. Farmers are sad about that too. These are the species that the farmers were enjoying themselves. But so much of it is that good farming is not financially viable. There's a very quite famous farmer, James Rebanks, up in the north of England. And he says that, he can't financially support himself on just his farming. He has to do his books. He has to do this other stuff on the side to enable him to farm in this way. Eventually, he's starting to see dividends. He's starting to see the land, because he's been putting so much into it. It's starting to work its way towards profitability. But farmers just don't have the time, and most of them don't have the time or money to do that. And and it's really, really sad. Instead of the conservationists, the farmers working together, they're just shouting at each other. And then you've got other issues, which is too much for this podcast. It's another podcast in itself, of issues such as rewilding and all these other debates that are going on, that are highly contested and highly volatile debates, and are not helping at the moment. But those sort of things were said in my first 2 years. And I can remember actually my professor saying explicitly, the farmers are the bad guys. And the rest of the class agreed. And I was sitting in the back going, not sure. And in my third year, no.
So most of our listeners aren't actually, you know, like large scale farmers, right? Most of them are people like you and me. I mean, first of all, let me ask you, Haddon, I know you're not a farmer, but do you garden at least?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yes, I'm currently looking at my tomato seedlings right now.
Cool. Okay. I am too, actually. So you garden in your little plot of land. This means you live in a town, right? In fact, I believe you've written about this town, kind of an ordinary, I forget what it's, Chelmsford. Is that correct?
Yep. Okay. Chelmsford.
Okay. So you live, I mean, depending on where you are in the world, you live a rather kind of quotidian, ordinary life, like most of us. So what are we, like normals, ordinary, non-farmers, what's our role in all this? Is there anything we are culprit in or anything we should do?
Yeah, this is a question I get asked a lot, actually, because I would say the majority of my readers are also non-farmers. The majority of the people I speak to are non-farmers. And it's a really difficult thing because so much of it is a system-wide thing, whether from governments or big supermarkets are the ones that are actually putting the pressure on farmers. And there's very little we can do as individuals to change that. But bringing it down to a local scale, which is where I always want to orientate my action, is on the local scale, because that's where I feel I can make a difference and I feel that people can make a difference. A lot of it, I think, is supporting your farmers directly where you can. For instance, we get our vegetables delivered to the door by a local organic farmer. And it costs money. It costs quite a bit more than buying them in the supermarket. But that is because I'm actually paying the proper price for the food. I'm actually paying what it costs the farmer to produce the food. The price you see in the supermarket is a price that farmers can't afford to produce at, especially in the UK. There was this big debate over Christmas where broccoli was being sold for 14p, which would be a matter of cents for you. And it looked like, oh, the supermarket was taking this big cut, so they're making everyone's Christmas dinner more affordable. And the farmers were saying, no, the supermarkets are getting exactly the same amount of money. They're just squeezing us. We're the ones that are bearing that load. So I think a big change is supporting your farmers directly where you can, buying from them directly. And that does make a real difference to them. Yeah. And also, you get to then speak to farmers.
I've heard the same is true in the US. So whenever you said, I'm not sure it's true here. I've heard it's something like in the West generally, like UK and US, we pay like the percentage of our money that we actually pay towards food is like super small compared to the rest of the world and compared to the rest of history. Like something like 6-7% of our money actually goes towards groceries, when the reality is a lot of the world pays like a third of their money or a quarter of their money. So I think that it's the same with us too. And I think it's largely government subsidized from what I understand.
Yeah. And something that's really great about the veg box delivery that we get is that the farmer's mother is the actual one that delivers it. And over time, we've got to know each other. And it's sort of a highlight of my week. And I think a highlight of her round, because she's often on the doorstep for 10 minutes and we're just talking and discussing farming practices, the weather, my writing and other things. And it's just great. And I think she loves the fact that someone's taking an interest in the farm and the farming life. I recently wrote an essay where I argued the farming life can be very, very isolated and very, very lonely. You don't really see many people unless you have a reason to move off the farm. So just taking an interest, visiting a farm, with permission, of course, can be such a great way of just getting to know farmers and getting to know their struggles, their joys, what farming is like for them, and what they wish you knew. We can sit here and discuss what's best for farmers, but actually they know what's best for farmers. They know what they need us to do. And listening to them, hearing from them, talking to them, that's what we need to do. And we need to make opportunities at farmers markets, at veg box delivery schemes, et cetera, to hear from them, to let their voice be heard. And yeah, through the limited interaction I've had with farmers, they always appreciate that, someone taking the time to listen, to give them a listening ear, to let them tell their stories. Farmers are great storytellers. They have so many stories from the land and from catastrophes that have happened and events that they've had to persevere through and bad weather years and when the calves were born and the twins were born and they were up late at night, et cetera, et cetera. They love telling stories. They're such interesting people.
Yeah, yeah. We, you know, it's funny, Haddon, we this morning, my wife and I were just talking about this. We live in a small community outside of sort of the larger community, and there are a lot of people out here who you know, grow, whether it's, we have a blueberry and blackberry farmer down the road. We have people who produce goats for meat and grow you know, cattle and all the things. We have a pretty robust farmers market, but we were talking this morning, my wife and I, Amber, and we had a hard frost last night. And she was thinking about our blackberry farmer down the road. And I said, well, you know, it was 28 degrees. How bad is that? And, you know, she had been talking to him and he was telling her that really it's like, you know, if it's below 28 degrees for 5 hours, it's really tough on any sort of new buds, which obviously the blackberries come from. And we were talking about that. And I said, well, has he ever experienced, you know, that effect on his crops? And she went on and on about a story he had told her about losing, you know, a good portion of his yields years ago. And it obviously led into things like climate change. And, you know, one story leads to the next. And all of a sudden you realize you're six stories deep, you know, the conversation all started with what effect does a hard frost have on your blackberries? And one of the things that I really loved about that was how well she got to know him, how many stories she got to hear about his life and his farming just all over this one little thing, which was, hey, we had a hard frost last night. So I'm curious, like, as you talk to farmers about, you know, whatever the trials and trails of being a small farmer, how many of those stories sort of branch into completely different conversations about family and community and, you know, whatever the thing is?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I wouldn't say I've spoken to a huge amount of farmers. It's something that I'm definitely seeking to do a lot more of. But the ones I have, yeah, it's so quickly. A family is one, especially if they are multi-generational farmers. They will talk about previous generations. They will talk about their forefathers. They will talk about the fact that they're so proud that their son or daughter has taken on the farm and all the success they've had and how they've brought the farm forward. I would say that the big issue that it quickly boils down to when you talk to farmers is the weather. Because that plays such an important part in their lives. For instance, I was just talking to the farm on the Sally who brings our vegetables around, and I was asking about the weather because we've had quite a strange weather this winter in the UK. It's been very mild and very, very wet. And I asked her, do they keep records of the weather? It'd be really interesting to see whether this is an abnormal month or whether this is a normal month. And she said, yeah, my husband's kept them back to 1970, kept weather records back to 1970 for his little area.
Holy cow.
And I was like, wow, that's incredible. She was like, she doesn't really know what to do with it. I was like, that is such a rich resource that he's got there. Because where they farm often experiences quite interesting microclimates. Sometimes it can be heavily raining a few kilometers away and they've had nothing for weeks and weeks and weeks. So that's really, really valuable information, that there must be so many stories interwoven within those records. But yeah, it quickly comes down to weather, pests, pest outbreaks is another one. talking to a farmer recently, and it was birds were the absolute menace on their fruit crops. But I would say it does stay on farming topics or farming periphery topics, because there is so much they have to talk about concerning those topics. It's such a rich field for stories. Like you say, you could be six stories deep within a conversation. It's an absolute delight. It's an absolute delight. I mean, you're mostly doing listening. You're not doing much talking, but that's fine.
And that's, you know, as a writer, that's like the best friend a writer can have, is somebody who's willing to share stories and let you just listen and
absolutely,
you know, participate where you can, but just mostly listen and translate those stories to your readers. Do you find yourself doing that a good bit in your writing? Because your writing is, like, to your point earlier, I think the thing that I fell in love with your writing is that it is so local. It is unashamedly local. And I think about writers like Wendell Berry or Wallace Stegner, people who just really honed in on a particular place, which you do. How much of the farming community and the conversations around that in your locality have sort of bled into your writing?
Yeah, some, I would say. Not as much as I would want to. Not as much as perhaps when you read my writings, you would think it's a lot more happening. Perhaps it's not as much as I would like it to. But whenever I hear a good story from a farmer, I think, what can I write on that? And I've got a few in draft form that are in the works. But what I would say is my local area is such a rich thinking ground. At the back of our house, we have an old cemetery, a non-conformist cemetery with some really interesting graves. And a lot of my essays have had their formation, me walking around the perimeter of that cemetery, just thinking and just thinking about themes of death, which is a topic that farmers deal with on a daily basis. Topics of abundance and harvest from the blackberries that grow in abundance on the cemetery. Looking at the graves and the names and the histories, I was thinking there's such a rich source of inspiration, literally a few hundred meters walk from where I am. There's enough here that would keep me busy for many years to come, just in this little local patch that I have here.
Haddon, what you just said is really important. Just the fact that, you know, that when you walk around, when you're in the cemetery, you're thinking about life and death. When you walk around your town, you know, you see things that sort of inspire your writing. I know that you've written a good bit of prose and poetry on just where you live and what it looks like and how it feels. Now, everyone who listens to this podcast is not a writer. But what would you say the average person should or could do to pay attention to their locality, and why is that important?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've written a few times on sort of just opening up your eyes, noticing things that you wouldn't otherwise notice, and really making a point of doing so. Your local area contains so much beauty, so much that's interesting, but we walk past it every day. I would assume that many listeners to this podcast are not walking around with their screen in front of their eyes in the street, but so many people do. Just putting the screen in your pocket, just look at a tree. Look at a tree, admire a tree and the beauty of a tree. Then learn its species, learn what type of tree it is, learn who planted it, if you can, et cetera, et cetera. Or going back to my cemetery, find the interesting places and look up the local history. That's how I got into that cemetery. It was by reading this, watching the video of a guy walking around explaining what the graves were. And I realized, whoa, there are so many really, really neat stories here. There is so much that's so much interesting. This is just not just a grave. This is the grave of a boy who disobeyed his mother and pricked his thumb and got sepsis at the age of 17, which is what one of the graves is, and it sort of is inscripted this, he didn't obey his mother, on the grave, and you're like, wow, here is a grave.
that's fascinating.
the best grave in the cemetery is a grave of a free man from New Orleans, so a slave that escaped New Orleans. Joseph, his name is, and he somehow managed to find his way to England, somehow managed to find his way to Chelmsford and lived here. And there's just this grave to a free man, Joseph. And I would have absolutely no idea that there is a freed, escaped slave buried in the cemetery behind my house. If I hadn't gone out and sought it, if I hadn't gone out and thought, this local area is worth studying, this local area is worth becoming an expert in. And that's something that I think we can all do, is become an expert in your local area, wherever that may be. There's plenty there for you to discover, plenty there for you to enjoy. And we need more local experts. We need more local historians. We need those that really notice their local fauna and flora, that know the names of the species that they live alongside. And it takes time, and it takes effort, and it takes being studious. Some of these things don't come easy or naturally. But if you invest the time, if you think that your local area is important enough for you to invest that time, then you will. And you will discover riches that you never even imagined were there. And that's been such a joy in digging into my local area, is discovering those things that you just would have absolutely no clue were here, and just been surprised again and again and again and again and again. And I thought I knew Chelmsford pretty well. It's a small city, but there is so much here, and there will be so much in every single listener's place. You just need to open your eyes, and maybe buy a good book or two about your local area. There's plenty out there. We're blessed in the UK with an army of local historians. Pretty much every local area has got local history books written about it, and they're brilliant.
Yeah, and some of my favorite experiences in the Ozarks, which is where I live, are around things like that, you know, dilapidated homesteads, abandoned buildings. I was just with a friend, Mike. We visited a small cemetery. This was one of the last remaining homesteads or plantations, rather, in Northwest Arkansas. And it would have been an area that, you know, would have had slaves. And there's a beautiful cemetery with the family from the plantation, and the local, you know, Arkansas, I guess, Architectural Society has located just down the hill a slave burial ground that is unmarked. And it's this really sort of sad story. A sad story emerges of, you know, the wealthy and the free who live on top of the hill. And those in history who have been outcast and forgotten and unmarked, and you know, now animals, you know, trod on their graves. And it's important not just because, you know, there's a local cemetery. It's important because of the narrative it tells of a community, and it also tells, you know, the story of how we can work to heal the wounds of a community. And I wonder, as you've kind of walked around your own local area, have you encountered stories like that where the deeper you dig, the more you see, oh, this is an area that is in deep, deep need of repair?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question that I hadn't really considered of my local area. I think as I walk around Chelmsford, I walk around with a heavy heart, because I see and I hear of all that we have lost. I think that's the loss and the repair that I most see, is that Chelmsford in a way has lost its soul, it's lost its heart. A great quote that I chuckle at on my local area, because I would say with some caveats, that Chelmsford is quite a boring place to live. For all its beauty, all its goodness that is there, you may have to look extra hard sometimes to see it. It is fairly boring, and that is by virtue of its proximity to London. If you want to go and do something, you hop on the train and go to London, 40 minutes train ride away. So Chelmsford has sort of been sort of hollowed out by its proximity to London. And I have a very famous writer who agrees with me on Chelmsford's boring status, and that's Charles Dickens, who had this to say about my hometown. Maybe he was a bit more brutal than I would be, but he said, "If anyone were to ask me what, in my opinion, was the dullest, most stupid spot on earth, I would decidedly say Chelmsford." Now, I was a bit taken aback when I read that. I thought he'd been maybe a bit harsh, but he has a point. And if Charles Dickens was writing that back whenever he did, Chelmsford, I don't know what he would say now. He would probably say it is utterly soulless. When we walk down our high street, for example, I am just shocked by the amount of chain stores and especially fast food restaurants are down there. And really weirdly lately, it's become American fast food restaurants have just populated Chelmsford. Like, I've never seen any of these restaurants anywhere else in the country, but we've got so many. We've got Popeyes, Louisiana Chicken. We've got KFC, which is fairly standard. Then we've got Wendy's and all these other, Taco Bell. I'm like, I've never seen these anywhere else in the country, but we've got so many down this one main street in Chelmsford. All these great shops, prime location shops, are just chain fast food restaurants. And that's, I find that so sad, that little independent restaurants really struggle here, that they're just, they pop up for a few years and then die. We have no real independent shops left here, apart from a few that exist in the periphery, but the high street is just chain store after chain store after chain store. All the old buildings, our old corn exchange was bulldozed to make way for a pretty horrible looking shopping mall. Chelmsford has sort of gotten rid of all its distinctives, all that made it unique and special. It sort of got rid of. I mean, we were the birthplace of radio, which is one of our big claims to fame. But all the factories closed ages ago, and now they're sort of just housing developments. You can't even go inside the buildings anymore. We have a great local museum just around the corner to us that documents all that. But that's really the only testament that is left. And that's what I see, is Chelmsford has really, really lost its soul. The independents, the small, the local, can't seem to survive here. And I'm not entirely sure why that is. But it's so, so, so sad. And I sort of think, what would it take for them to survive here? And the answer would be, it would take local people supporting those shops, making sure that they are patrons of those places, making sure that they advocate for the small shops against the chain stores. The chain stores can just so easily come, but if there's enough local resistance, then perhaps they stand a chance. It involves, yeah, making those decisions that even though it's more expensive to shop at those shops. And that's something I do. A habit of mine is whenever I go into an independent bookshop, because I know that they're really struggling in the UK at the moment with the cost of living crisis. People are thinking that book buying is a luxury, so they're massively pulling back. I then go and I make sure that I buy one or two. A, because I like books, but also because I know that actually that purchase really makes a difference to those shop owners. Makes a disproportionate influence to those shop owners, shall we say. And if enough people did that, if enough people committed to do that, then we would see these shops and these businesses have a fighting chance. But it does take that critical mass of local people to be locally engaged in their local area, in the local goodness that they see. And when I look around me, I don't see that critical mass of people. I don't see that number of people that are concerned. You see these stickers sometimes in shop windows, support shop local, support your local business. But I don't see enough people doing it. And from the local business owners that I've seen on social media, they're all really struggling. Their footfall is all massively down. And they're really, really, they don't know how they'll exist in a year's time. Yeah. It's happening in Chelmsford, it's happening across the country. And it's that makes me so sad. Because it's a delight to walk in these shops.
For those shop owners or the small farmer that you referenced earlier who drops off vegetables to your door, there's a different sort of freedom that comes when you're operating your own space, selling your own wares, crafting your own goods, than when you have to sort of, you know, immerse yourself or be taken over, for lack of a better phrase, by this sort of global commercial ubiquity, you know, of the chain store that I know we see here and I know you see there. That leads me a little bit to maybe a different topic of conversation, though. I think it's related. You and I have both spilled a great amount of ink on artificial intelligence. And it strikes me that what you're describing about this sort of commercial ubiquity, the creeping commercial ubiquity, is really just a gateway to a larger sort of, you know, collective instead of local, I guess I should say, experience, right? Of entering into virtual spaces, artificial spaces, spaces that by no accounts are tangible and real. And so I wonder how you feel, one, about artificial intelligence, but two, how these virtual spaces, artificial spaces, how do you see those sort of disrupting this fight for the soul of your community?
Ooh, what a question. On AI, I am solidly against it, with caveats, of course. I see its potential in some areas. A really good example is conservation, actually. It's a really interesting tool for conservation. I've seen there's been some people that are using it to identify snow leopards, for instance, in photographs, by training it to find the snow leopard that's incredibly camouflaged in the picture, so they can monitor populations, etc., etc. So there are some uses, but I would say I'm firmly against anything to do with creativity, so-called creativity and AI. I think it's a fraud, basically. I think it is a cheap shot. And as I've written before, I see it as completely inauthentic. When I read a book, I want to hear what the author says. I don't want to hear what a computer says. No matter how good the argument is, in a way, it's sort of not a real argument for me if it's just a machine just churning out words that it logically thinks follow on one after the other. It's nothing that I would cite in an essay, for instance. I would never cite AI. I would go and find something that's similar written by a real human author. But the danger that I see is as AI becomes better and better and better, it becomes harder and harder and harder to distinguish between what is AI and what is not. And as I've argued, I find that an incredibly disorientating place to be in, when I can never assume that a picture or a video is real anymore, when I can never assume that the words that I'm reading online are actually written by a human person. That's disorientating. That can mess with your head, and you can start to doubt everything, because in a way you need to doubt everything, and constantly doubting everything is a horrible place to be in. It's an exhausting place to be in, but it is fast becoming the world that we live, and I want to push back against that, and I want to see writers, I want to see creatives commit to having nothing to do with AI. May their writing, their art be certified AI free. I call it refuge of authenticity, so that you can come here and experience the real in a sea of artificiality. And yeah, there may be those that argue that it's an entry point for creatives. It's a help. It's a helping hand. But I would say that once you start, it is very difficult to disentangle yourself from that mesh that you've woven yourself into. Once you start to get AI to produce for you, your A, you're putting yourself in sort of this production line where you're producing content, and AI can do that much quicker for you. And if people are starting to demand that from you, then you just go to AI all the time because it can do it much quicker, much faster. And there are so many other pitfalls and traps that you can fall into with when you start to give things over to AI. And I would say the best thing to do is just have nothing to do with it and to build a reputation around that. Make people know that you are not using it. Make that claim. And by making that claim, you are holding yourself to it. If I hadn't started suddenly to write AI on my blog, I'd feel like a fraud and a hypocrite. So I'm not going to do that. The fact that I've made that claim means that I'm less likely to then go away and give in. I wouldn't say the temptation's there at the moment, but perhaps when we live in a world where people are producing essays in seconds that are very well written, that are perfect prose, et cetera, but it is AI, the temptation will be there for creatives to give in so that they can compete. Now, I hate the word competition. I don't think writers should be competing against each other. But that world is on the horizon unless some pretty significant regulation is put in play on AI. And I can't see that coming anytime soon. But how it influences my local area, that's something I've not even begun to consider. I could maybe imagine that my local newspaper might eventually be written by AI. It's not great as it is, but that would be such a shame because it's a bit quirky, it's a bit not well written, et cetera, but it's someone trying to do something local, and it'd be such a shame if it was just turned over to this AI which just produces the same content again and again and again, the same voice, tone, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that is something that I will have to go away and think about. I think actually, I don't know is the answer yet. I don't know how AI influences the local. I think in a way the local, it creates obstacles in a way for AI in that ideally in a local area, you are known and you know, and I think you can detect inauthenticity a lot easier when you're ingrained in a local area. If someone who can't write suddenly can write, then you start to get suspicious. If someone's voice or tone changes in what they're writing, then you start to get suspicious. If someone's art form changes or they're mass producing stuff and you know them, you start to get suspicious. So I think our local areas can be these refuges of authenticity. But we've got to guard against it and never underestimate AI. I think that's something I've learned the last few weeks, months, is never underestimate it. It's constantly learning.
You're using this term, refuges of authenticity. You're the first person I actually heard use that term, so maybe that's your term.
It is my term.
Okay, yeah, and I loved it. I mean, the first time I read it, I was like, yeah, this is, you know, for years, Tish and I, you know, came up with this phrase about analog resistance years ago with Tish in Italy. And the first time I heard refuges of authenticity, I thought that's exactly what he's talking about. That's it. Explain to me why you think refuges of authenticity, like why is that a human imperative?
I think because it comes down to, again, that seeing and being known, that to be authentic, you need to be known. And I don't think you can know someone fully through mediated through technology. Like I can see you, I can see your face, but I'm not really interacting with Seth. I'm interacting with Seth on my screen. To be authentically known, you have to be in close proximity. You have to actually know and see the physicality of the person. So an artificial can never be authentic. Why it's a refuge, I think, is what I was explaining earlier about not knowing what is true and not knowing what is real is an incredibly disorientating place to be in. It's an incredibly dangerous place to be in. I don't want to constantly be thinking, does this mountain that I'm seeing in this photograph actually exist? I don't want to be thinking, is this person actually saying that? It's going to be absolutely terrible in a political election year for both of us, both countries. We've not been able to know the political videos that you're watching. Are they real? Are the politicians really saying that? Is this just being generated by some spam bot? Being constantly in that frame of mind where you're doubting and questioning everything is horrible. And I want to create a place where people can come and they don't need to have those doubts. They don't need to have those questions. They can come and they can read something that they know is produced by a human, a human that has wrestled with the text that they're reading, a human that has wrestled over these words, and they've produced something that hopefully is beautiful and can be enjoyed and reveled in. And you can think, I will never stand in awe of an art piece that AI has created, because I know there was no pain and toil and effort required to get there. I stand in awe of a masterpiece painting because I know that I'm witnessing creativity that I can scarcely fathom in front of me. I'm seeing an artist who was bent over this easel for weeks, months, and has created something incredibly beautiful. For me, AI takes away that emotion of awe, that emotion of surprise, that emotion of gratitude, and replaces it with doubt, and replaces it with cheapness, artificiality. And I don't want anything to do with that. And I want to create a place where people can come and experience those emotions, or I want to see communities where people can experience those, online communities of creatives and communities of real embodied people getting together and showcasing their work, and it being certified AI free, not through any certification system, but just through the authentic word of the person saying, I can assure you, AI has had nothing to do with this. And again, that can be done very easily at a local stage, at a local scale. So there, the local provides a space for there to be these refuges of authenticity that perhaps you couldn't get on a more global scale or even a national scale.
You know, and I think that's really, to your point, I think that's really important, because the thing that you raised that makes us fundamentally different than a machine is the pain, the pain of life. It's the joy of life too. I don't want to give that away, but with every great act of creativity, there comes a certain amount of pain. To bleed on a page requires a certain amount of pain. To write a poem, as you know, for mass consumption creates a whole lot of pain, because one, it takes a lot of work to craft a short poem. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the minute you release it, your readership is likely going to brush over it, not even really spend the time that it takes to really understand the poem, because that's what poetry does. And yet there are those out there who write these pieces of poetry from a deep place of artistic pain, knowing that really the only thing that they're offering is this little slice of humanity, what it means to be human. And not everyone's going to read it, and not everyone's going to care about it. And that is, to me, the essence of being an artist, is saying, come hell or high water, I am going to put my pain on a page.
I would just like to add to your point there about pain on the page. I think as well, it's your limits are expressed on the page. And limits is something that I discuss a whole lot on Over the Field. I would actually say limits is probably the guiding framework of my writing, is what does it mean to live well in limits, especially that with the farmer. My first essay was The Good Farmer and His Limits. And I argue that you can only flourish as a human being when you live inside your limits. AI is unlimited. And I think that is a critical problem for creativity when you have unlimitedness. Your limits bound you, your limits hone you, your limits hone your skills. The limits show you there's things that you need to go away and think about a whole lot more deeply. And if I tried to write on everything, I would burn out pretty quickly. But I stay in my lane I developed my expertise within that lane, I realize there's a whole lot I don't understand. That's why some of my essays are heavily caveated, because I realize there's a whole lot I don't understand. But it's within those limits that we flourish. Those limits are there for our good. And AI doesn't have any of that. And I see that as a huge, huge problem, which I think really... I love your point, pain on the page. That's a fantastic quote. But I'll go away and think about. As for me, sometimes I struggle to find words. I have to consult thesauruses a whole lot. And that's the pain I experience, is really wrestling with what is the word that I want to convey? What word conveys the meaning, the message that I want it to in this essay? And that's what takes up a whole lot of my time. Writing an essay is finding those words, going through that process of discovering new words that I can use. And it is painful. It takes a whole lot of mental toil, but I do eventually find that word. And it's joyful when you find the word that you know expresses it perfectly. And at the end of the day, AI is not fun. It's painful to write an essay, but it's also fun. And it's fun to press publish and know that you've written something that's good. You don't get that of AI. You may get some thrill of just producing again and again and again, and that sort of addictive dopamine. But it's not fun. Writing's fun sometimes.
Yeah, it is, and it comes through your work, man.
Thank you. I never imagined I would be a writer. I always thought that science would be the area that I go into. But I've just enjoyed writing. I've enjoyed the fact that a massive part of what I do is just reading the work of others and just being bowled over again and again and again by their insight and thinking, I want to replicate a little bit of that in the little ways that I can, through Wendell Berry, Paul Kingsnorth, Ivan Illich. These are some of the key writers that have influenced me, and just being able to spend time in their work is just such a joy. And that's, I think, for people that come to Over the Field, that's what they can expect. They can expect to see writers who have influenced me going through time and time again in my writing. They can expect to see a whole lot of localism stuff, a lot of farming, some stuff on tech, which I do see as such a key issue for not only creativity but also farming. How do we deal with technology in farming? Technology is a good thing, but it also it has caused some of the problems that we were discussing earlier on in the podcast about intensification, etc. So what does a faithful use of technology in farming look like? And I think what I would perhaps most like people to come away with my writings is, here is someone who is wrestling with issues, who doesn't have all the answers, but is wrestling towards some conception of the good life. That's where all my essays are pointed to, what Wendell Berry calls the good life. And I'm trying to explore, what does that look like in my local area? What does that look like for farming? What does that look like for ecology and nature and creation? And that's a journey that I want to take my readers on with me to wherever destination we go in this fast changing world.
Yeah, and you've done a great job. So what we're going to do is we're going to leave in the show notes links to your Substack, which are, it's amazing. Go read all the archives. Just spend time there. Spend a whole day there. Carve out a Saturday. Just read along. I think they're going to love you, and they're going to love your writing as I do, and I know Tish does. So as we wrap up the podcast today, tell me, what is one thing that you're reading, watching, listening to, et cetera, that is bringing some goodness, truth, or beauty to your life?
So I thought about how I'm going to answer this question, and my mind immediately went to birdsong. So it has been absolutely such a joy sitting in my study, overlooking the cemetery, and just over the last week, hearing the birdsong again after the long dead winter. It's been such a joy. It's just noticing it, listening to the chiff chaff, listening to the dunnock, listening to the robin, the blackbird, and just listening to that symphony that I get to experience every single day, and it is just so beautiful. And I've really made an effort to just really listen and really notice. And then if I could add just one more thing, I'm currently reading a book called Tyr. I'm probably pronouncing that massively wrong, as it's in Welsh. But it's a book on, it's a book by an author that I've been following for quite a while, who is another, I think, quite young author. And he's writing the story of the Welsh landscape. And his argument is that the Welsh landscape is a beautiful landscape, but that is because of the mixture of people and nature. And you cannot isolate one from the other. And I think that's such an important message when we look at farming, is that the beauty that we see in the United Kingdom especially is because of farms, is because of the farming practice that have been going on for centuries. And we have farmers to thank for that. And we can't just remove them from the landscape and expect that beauty to persist. And Carwin Graves, in this book, he hammers that point home using story, using Welsh literature, which I have no clue. Thankfully, he translates it. And through just a really well-argued piece that is beautifully written, and just contains so many beautiful stories of little farmers in their little valley, who just wax lyrical about their local area, the local beauty they have. So I've been really, really enjoying that book, and there will be a review of it coming on Over the Field in the next few weeks.
Sweet. I can't wait to read it. For me, I'll just end it with, because Tish is not here, technical issues. So for me, I've been really digging into a particular photographer named Blair Speed. She is out west in the United States. I've been looking at her photos. Her frames are amazing. They're really, really sparse in a good way, in the best way. Tight frames, captures moments, tells stories. Every shot has a story. And I love her work. So we'll leave a link to that too. Haddon, I really appreciate you coming. Sorry for the technical difficulties that we've had today, but it's been so great to have you with us.
It's been a pleasure, and it just proves that technology is not the be-all and end-all. We actually need community, doesn't it?
100%. That's 100% true. Yeah. Anyway, Haddon, it's been really good to talk to you, and I think we'll probably do this again, if I'm guessing.
We're well up for that.
So if you hadn't noticed, it got really quiet from me for about 2/3 of that conversation. And I promise it wasn't a lack of interest. It was entirely 100% tech issues. I was so annoyed, especially because this is a topic I'm so passionate about. And I was so glad to finally have Haddon on the episode. I've been wanting to talk to him for a long time. So join me in commiserating if you don't mind. So whenever Haddon was talking about the farmer where he gets his veg, I was wanting to talk about the family where we get our raw milk from. You know, the 15-minute drive from our house to their little farm is honestly legit one of my highlights of the week now. Or the farmers where I get our family's meat from at our local farmer's market, and how she gave me her phone number so I could just text her what meat I'd like set aside to make sure there's enough for us when we got to the market. It's genuinely been a joy and a privilege to support our local farmers and makers and artisans this way. And I highly, highly recommend doing one small thing of that caliber in your area within your budget if you're able. You know, whether it's coffee or, I don't know, soap or veggies or milk or locally made salsas or tamales. I mean, you can tell where I'm from, I guess. You won't regret these trade-offs. You know, whether those trade-offs are slightly more time or money or effort to invest in them, we vote with our dollars. And spending money in our local communities really is a way we can vote for the type of place where we want to live. Anyway, that's the gist of what I would have said were my tech to have worked for the duration of that conversation. But this means I'm truly glad Seth was back on the mic for this one particular chat so he could spearhead it. And I guess it just means I hope that we have Haddon back on the show soon. So, well, that is going to wrap this one up. You can find all episodes at adrinkwithafriend.com, where you can also help support the show by picking up the next round of drinks. Because remember, this show is free for you to listen to, but it's not free for us to make. So at just the cost of a cup of coffee or a pint, you can help keep the lights on around here. And we are really grateful you do so. You can find me and all my stuff at tishoxenwriter.com. You can find Seth at sethhaines.com, and you can find Haddon Turner's excellent newsletter at overthefield.substack.com. And for all of this, as always, you can just head to the show notes of this episode and you'll find the links there. Kevin McLeod did the music, Kyle Oxenrider did the editing, and let's be honest, mostly Seth and Haddon did the talking in this one. I'll be back here with you again soon. In the meantime, thank you so much for being here. Have a great rest of your day.